From ACB Radio Mainstream, welcome to Tuesday Topics. For the next hour, we will be discussing a topic of interest to blind and visually impaired people. And now, from Miami, Florida, the host of Tuesday Topics, Paul Edwards.
I am Paul Edwards from Miami, Florida, where the wet weather was supposed to be dry but has been rainy this evening. I'd like to thank Brian Charlson, our producer, and in particular, I'd like to thank Steve Bauer, our technician and recorder extraordinaire, who turns our maunderings into a wonderful program every week. Thank you, Mr. Bauer. We appreciate it, and we hope the weather is nice in Kansas. I'd also, of course, like to thank George Byes from Talking Communities, without whose software we would not be doing these programs. So, Mr. Byes, we not only appreciate the fact that you created the software through Talking Communities, but that you make it available to ACB Radio. Thank you, sir. My guest this evening, aside from being a person well worth listening to in the area of access, happens to be one of my very best friends. I was present at his last wedding to his lovely wife, Nancy, and he was my counselor when I went through the rehab center in the state of Florida in, 1977, I think, which is a pretty long time ago. In fact, 31 years ago, which is how long I've been in Florida. Gosh, time flies when you're having fun. But Doug and I, when we both lived in Daytona Beach, which we did for a number of years, were kind of known as the dynamic duo in the field of advocacy. And if people could manage to keep one of us away from an event, that was a good thing. If both of us were there, people knew that they were in trouble. I am really very honored to have Doug as a guest on Tuesday Topics. And perhaps, Doug, you might begin by telling us a little bit about who you are, where you grew up, and maybe, if you don't mind, talk a little bit about how you became a part of the blind community, and a little about your education, and perhaps what brought you to Florida.
Just give you a little. First of all, Paul, you mentioned about our wedding. Do you realize that wedding was 24 years ago yesterday?
That's scary. I knew it was about this time of year. Happy anniversary to both of you. And by the way, if you want to persuade Nancy to join us later on the program, she's more than welcome, because Nancy, Doug's wife, is also a wonderful advocate. Nancy and Doug and I became sort of the dynamic trio for on a lot of advocacy issues in the 70s and early 80s. And some of my fondest memories of getting things done have to do with time spent with Doug and Nancy. And wow, happy anniversary, you guys.
Thank you. Okay, a little bit of background about me. Actually, I was blinded due to a dynamite blasting accident in 1956. I was my vision went from 20/20 to zero in like a heartbeat. How did I get involved? Well, I really wasn't very involved in the whole blindness and disability movement until I moved to Florida. Actually, about the time I met you, Paul, Carl McCoy, who was then the director of the center, said he would hire me. However, I had to agree if he hired me to be involved in the community. And I think Carl created a monster in me. You're right. Sometimes people called us the dynamic duo, and sometimes they called us the gruesome twosome, depending on what we were up to. In terms of my background, I got a bachelor's degree in psychology. I was thinking politics, but decided I wasn't that kind of person. Got a bachelor's in psychology, and then went on and got a master's in counseling at the University of New Hampshire, and was recruited by Carl McCoy to come to Florida to work at the then Rehabilitation Center as a counselor. And two reasons I think I was hired. One is because I was blind, and he was looking for somebody who was blind. And second, he was looking for somebody who had a background in mental retardation. I had that background as a volunteer. I worked at a school for the mentally handicapped in New Hampshire. So I came down here to work, and Carl got me involved in the community. Along with you and a bunch of other people, we got involved in lots of different things. And then he got me involved in the Florida Council. And that began lots of years of story. I think I've been very active in the council since. Basically, my first convention, or my first meeting, was in 1977. And I think I've missed about five in the past 30-some years.
That's pretty amazing. I think I can probably beat you. I don't think I've missed that many. But I got involved at about the same time. So again, we were kind of the young Turks who were being rude to the establishment within FCB and asking it to go in some directions that it traditionally hadn't gone in. One of the things that we did relatively early was Doug and I also went around the state a lot trying to get new chapters of the organization started, and we also began to work to really restructure the way that the organization ran. And one of the things that we did relatively early on was to turn what was a pretty loose structure into a much more organized structure, where we created committees that were going to work on specific issues. And one of the committees that we created was the Access Committee. For those of you who go back that far, you will remember that in the late 1970s and early 1980s, that was really where it was at. All of us in the disability rights movement were primarily working on issues that we could really describe as access issues. And we wanted to create ways that accessibility could be broadened. Doug, to his credit, has stuck with the Access Committee virtually from its inception, and for the last long time, Doug has been chair of that committee. And maybe, Doug, you could tell us a little bit about some of the issues that the committee's working on now.
By the way, I think I've been chair for about 20 years. I think you were chair before me. The Access Committee, frankly, the Access Committee has been very successful, and I think the reason it's been successful is because we've got a great bunch of people on that committee, and they've been on it for years. I just chair the thing. The members of the committee are the ones who really take hold and work on various things. Some of the issues we handle, or we've handled in the past, if you remember here in Florida, it's a few years ago, there was no such thing as a talking ATM in the banks. Our Access Committee took that on as a project, working with Laney Feingold and the people in California, and now we've got several thousand talking ATMs in Florida. I think you and I, Paul, kind of worked on that one years ago to get it going. I think that's been a real successful area to work. If you remember, when the committee first started, it actually was called the Transportation and Architectural Barriers Committee. And then we split it off into Transportation and Access and two committees, which I think worked out well. We also, we've worked on transportation. That's probably the number one problem that people who are blind and people with disabilities have is transportation. So we've spent a lot of time talking about that. We've dealt with, and you had mentioned in your note that you sent out, our initiative we've been working on, thanks to Debbie Grubb, the Intermodal Transportation Coalition that was set up about a year and a half, 2 years ago, to actually work on trying to do something about the real problem we have in Florida of getting between counties, getting around the state. We all know that Greyhound and the trains and even the airplanes have cut way back. It's very difficult to get from here to wherever. So we've asked the governor's office, to study the issue to try to come up with a solution so people who don't drive can actually get from one place to another. We didn't have a lot of success with the governor's office in doing that. So thanks to Debbie and several other people, and people from other organizations, we got together and formed the Intermodal Transportation Coalition. The purpose of that, in a nutshell, is to look at various issues and try to force officials to make some really strong decisions about doing something about people who can't drive. And one of the things we're looking at is trains and anything else that we need to be able to get around. So transportation is another area that we've spent a lot of time talking about. Even though we're not the transportation committee, we spend a lot of time working on it.
I think that maybe we could spend a little bit more time talking about where this intermodal transportation thing came from. And I think perhaps the best way we can explain it, it suddenly became clear to us in Florida that something was happening which was impacting our members in an absolutely atrocious ways, in several atrocious ways. Greyhound and Trailway buses were cutting whole communities out of their routes. Trains stopped stopping in particular areas. Planes quit flying to particular cities. And suddenly, even some pretty substantially large communities in the state of Florida were effectively cut off from each other. And that problem continues to happen in Florida, and we suspect it's actually a national problem. I don't think it's just in Florida that transportation is becoming much more a question of whether you can drive or not. We don't think either that it's a problem that applies just to people who are blind. We think it applies to older people who can't drive anymore. We think it also applies to poor people who can't afford to buy cars. And we also think that it probably applies a lot to people with other disabilities who, for a variety of reasons, can't drive. The bottom line, though, is we believe that there are huge numbers of people who are effectively trapped in their communities unless they can find ways of driving. Now, Doug, you mentioned that one of the things that we were looking at as a solution was trains, and maybe you could spend a little bit of time talking about why trains look to us like a viable solution.
Are correct. By the way, I wanted to go back to something you said. The thing you said about other people not being able to use their cars and whatever it is, I think that's the strength of our coalition. We're pulling in people from various disability groups. We're pulling in older people. We're pulling in all sorts of individuals that have difficulty with transportation to try to form a real powerful coalition. If we looked at all the people who are transportation disadvantaged, who could participate in our coalition, it'll give us, I think, the political strength we need to make people pay attention.
Yep. So talk to me about trains.
Okay. Actually, this started, the whole transportation thing really got its impetus from John Mica, the congressman from Central Florida. He's a big supporter of the train and trying to get things going. We feel that it may not be the answer to everybody, but the train, you know, it's a big thing, it's a very popular thing, and it's very successful in Europe. There's no reason why it can't be done here if people wanted it to work. So with the problem with Greyhound and other things, we thought, well, the train might be a possibility, especially since we have some very powerful political officials interested in pushing it. So we're looking at that as a start. Right now, I think what they're looking at is mainly from Central Florida or Jacksonville down to Miami area, but I think it can spread in the future. So I think it's a way that we need to look at going.
What we're actually referring to is a proposal that actually had the chance to attract a pretty large chunk of federal dollars. That would have created high-speed train service from Jacksonville to Miami and also There was certainly talk about creating a second corridor that essentially would have run from the east to the west coast, perhaps from Daytona to Tampa, St. Pete. The idea was to create two corridors, one in either direction, that would in effect be the centers of a large transportation infrastructure that in our view, and in the view of many who were actually proponents of the system, would have begun to solve the problem. There was opposition raised to the high-speed train, and currently the development appears to be stalled, and in the current economic times it becomes a little bit questionable as to whether it can be built again. But it's the kind of infrastructural change that we think these very economic times make even more viable, because with depleted energy and continually rising energy costs in spite of the current dip, we think that things like trains that will allow for mass transit at a relatively low cost, and that will also allow for the transit of some high-priced goods as well, make some real sense to us. Let's talk about two other issues, Doug, if we could, and then we're going to open things up here. Let's talk about accessible pedestrian signals as another area that the Access Committee has worked on. And then when we're done with that, I'd like to talk for a minute about the work that we've done in terms of information access. Even though that hasn't been directly the work of your committee, I'd like us to spend a minute talking about it. To begin with, let's talk about accessible pedestrian signals. Is that an area where we've begun to have some success in Florida as well?
I think we are having some success in some areas. I think officials, especially state officials, are dragging their feet. It's new. They're not so sure they like it. They have a lot of questions. And the fact that the Department of Transportation is kind of lax on it, I think it local areas are saying, well, we don't want to do it. Some areas are doing it. We're getting a lot of people understanding. One of the things we've been doing in terms of pedestrian access and safety awareness is the whole issue of white cane awareness. Here in Daytona, we're now calling it white cane and pedestrian safety awareness to bring out other people to be involved. And we're actually working from the inside, like you and I did, Paul, years ago. We're working from the inside, convincing officials that it's a good idea. We're actually getting officials out there crossing the street and working with us. They're beginning to say yes. I think a lot of the technology is improving, and that's going to be a help. One of the things we keep saying, and a lot of the officials are concerned about the cost, and we've been showing evidence that it really doesn't cost any more for an accessible signal than it does to upgrade an existing signal that doesn't have it. So I think with education, we'll hopefully be able to get people to want to do it themselves. I've been a believer for a long time that when it comes to change, it's an attitude. If a person has an attitude they don't want to change, it doesn't matter what you do. What we need to do is have people understand and believe that it's a good idea. And that's one of the things we're working on with the Access Committee. I want to mention quickly here that thanks to Debbie Grubb and ACB, there was a really good publication put out by ACB on the whole issue of pedestrian signals. And I encourage everyone to go online, go to ACB, download that copy and read it. And I expect that'll be updated in the near future.
There are, as we speak, plans to see it updated. We've tried to provide our local chapters with enough information based on training that we've done at conventions that have enabled them to take the ball and run with it. And in some communities, we've been pretty successful. In Miami, it's kind of been stop and go and go again. We're actually, I think, now back on an up cycle, and my expectation is that within the next 2 years in Miami, we will have over 100 accessible pedestrian signals, which I think is a pretty good deal. I had the opportunity of turning around what could have been some disastrous notions in the Public Works Department through the Commission on Disability Issues here in Miami. And luckily, I think we're now back on track, and we're going to see a rapid deployment of a lot more accessible pedestrian signals down here. So that's a good thing. So let's talk for just one moment about one final issue that I think is noteworthy, and that is our push here in Florida to try to do something about making the state responsible for assuring that the information that it was putting up on websites and the ways that it was setting up software in state agencies continued to be accessible for folks who are blind. Could you talk for just a couple of minutes about that, Doug?
Sure. Actually, the person who's been doing the most on that is Robert Miller. But yeah, I think I can. Just to give you a little, our listeners a little history. The legislature a few years ago did finally get off the stick and finally said they would meet 508, the federal 508 thing, saying that software and the internet state things would be accessible, which was fine. But the problem is they also decided that any existing ones would stay the same. And the only time it would be fixed the correct way is when they did something new, which is a problem because the state is full of software and full of internet access sites that are not accessible, which is creating a problem. Unfortunately, the legislature and the governor was afraid it was going to cost too much money. I think it's a question of where they want to spend their money rather than how much it is. We need to continue working on that. I'm really hoping, and speaking of access, I'm hoping that our effort in the legislature with our Vision Caucus will continue to grow in terms of members, and we'll be able to push some of those issues. I think our whole access effort in terms of the legislature and anything else is going to hinge on us getting support, and I'm hoping that the Vision Caucus will give us that kind of support.
What was interesting about the information access here in Florida is that it was initially a non-issue here, and we threatened to take action against the state because there were a number of blind people who lost their jobs because of inaccessible software. And the governor agreed based on, I think, directly on pressure that we applied to set up a task force that came back with a report that was actually pretty good and pretty strong, which turned into legislation that wasn't very strong and regulations that were even weaker. We're now at the stage, I think, where it's time to actually test the limits of that law. And I know that at our board meeting coming up in December, we'll be looking at an issue because there is one of our members who has contacted an attorney, and the attorney is interested in taking this case forward and looking for some FCB support. I think that the whole point of what we've been talking about tonight is to try to indicate that at the state level, if you've got a good structure and you've got good people in leadership roles, you're actually able to make some pretty fundamental changes, and you're actually able to move things forward. I think we can point at the four areas that we've talked about tonight as areas where we really have been successful as an organization of the blind at taking a leadership role in the state and making things change. And what what we hoped by discussing some of the stuff that we're doing here in Florida was to encourage folks from other states to get involved in some similar efforts. So let me, if I may, ask Doug if he has any final comments before we open it up, and then we'll open it up to see if people have comments or questions that they'd like to share.
Yeah, two things quickly, Paul, I wanted to mention. One is the whole issue of voting. Thanks to some people who have really been working on it for the last, 8 years or so, Florida now is probably one of the most up-to-date states in terms of voting access for people who have print disabilities. There are a lot of changes still need to be made, but we are pushing the issue. The other thing I wanted to mention, it's one of the relatively new things we've been working on, is the whole issue of point-of-sale devices. That is, the devices that people use when they're using their debit cards and you type in your number into the card. We're getting stores to go back to using keys instead of the flat panel, which I think has been very successful, and I think that will continue to improve.
Yep. And I think what we should probably say about ATMs and point of sale machines is that's where affiliates can really play an absolutely crucial role. It's relatively easy. That's probably not fair. And Lainey Feingold and Linda Dardarian will be pointing guns at me for saying it. But let me perhaps say it another way. The simple part in terms of long-term implementation is getting structured negotiations to work with stores and with banks. The real issue, though, is actually being sure that those devices, A, end up getting deployed, and B, that the agreements that the companies come to are actually kept. And that's where blind people and affiliates need to be the watchdogs, where we need to be going out and going into these stores, seeing if in fact they're doing what they're supposed to, that is, that a proportion of their lanes actually do have accessible point of sale machines, for instance, or that an appropriate proportion of the ATM machines in a local community operated by a given bank are in fact talking ATMs. If we don't continue to put pressure, if we don't continue to make this an issue, then it doesn't happen. It's relatively simple then for structured negotiations to happen, but for the implementation and deployment to work is up to those of us who are blind getting out there and making sure that the stuff happens on the ground.
From ACB Radio Mainstream, you are listening to Tuesday Topics. If you have comments about the show or a suggestion of a topic you would like to have discussed, send a message to TuesdayTopics@acbradio.org. That's TuesdayTopics@acbradio.org. Once again, the host of Tuesday Topics, Paul Edwards.
Let's open it up and see if people have comments or questions for Doug. So that we can move our discussion forward.
Doug, this is Gary Wood from Lansing, Michigan. You know, you'd mentioning about changing attitudes of people. You know, when it comes to accessibility for the blind, I think that the thing that probably must be said is that, like, it costs money to make things accessible, but to me, I think that even though more money is spent in that endeavor, it seems like you actually get back a lot more than you give when you spend money on those things. I mean, you get a return on your investment because I think probably for people getting jobs and in that respect. And like we had this millage that finally passed involving our transportation here, what they call the CATA, and not just blind people, but if that hadn't passed, people would have lost jobs because they work in the evening sometimes. And with this millage not passing, people would not have been able to use the bus or on the weekends. People don't like, especially with tough times, people don't like millages because they have enough times making ends meet as it is. But But people don't need a millage when times are good. But maybe sometimes you have to spend to get once in a while.
That's a really good point, Gary, you made. Yes, you do have to spend money sometimes. But, you know, I think most people need to really realize that accessibility creates jobs, creates money, creates income, rather than doing away with it. I think we need to convince officials that making accessible is going to increase rather than decrease. I don't think it costs as much as some people try to say it does. There are many things that we can do to make things more accessible that don't cost a lot of money. A lot of it is just scare tactics and ignorance.
This is Dave McElroy, Visalia, California. I'd like to make a couple of comments here. Number one, I believe that, Paul, you are correct. I believe this is the problem of transportation is a national one. And I think there are a couple of things that are going on. Though they may be getting more expensive over time, the availability of automobiles is quite a bit more enhanced than it was even 20 or 30 years ago. I mean, a car, the auto companies now all have financial arms to them, and they all provide, 0% loans. How can you turn down 0% money to buy a car? The average family, whereas in the, 50s, in 1959, say, might have had one car, now has three. This goes on, and so, of course, the perception is that there's no need for other transportation options. Now, one of the problems we have here in Visalia is, in terms of the buses, that the majority of people on the buses are, in all honesty, people I would not want to hang around with, people I would not want to ever have to associate with, drug people, the homeless people, people that I could not, in good conscience, expose my grandchildren to. I can't take my grandchildren on our own buses because of the type of people. And I'm sorry. This is not going to help us with the public because, if you go to a store and you say, we want more bus access to the malls, they'll say, well, what kind of people are you bringing in? Oh, the druggies and the homeless. They're not going to be interested in that, Paul. I don't know what we do. I'd like to, it would be nice, but I just don't see that's, Now, going to a more positive note, I wonder if we couldn't and shouldn't be proposing accessible pedestrian signals for school crossings. What could be more helpful to school kids than a speaker that tells you when to cross the street? And it's just an addition for not only blind but also for everybody else. That would benefit a pedestrian, all facets of pedestrianism, I would think.
A really good point on that. I think in terms of getting success in achieving, whether it be transportation or pedestrian signals or whatever, I think those of us who are blind are a very small minority of people with disabilities. I think when you want success, it takes numbers or money. A politician told me once that they do things based on number of votes and the amount of money people spend. Well, if we can get people in wheelchairs and people that are older and the children and blind and everybody else to agree with us, it's a large number of people. We have a much better chance, I think, of success if we bring in other people. That's one of the strengths of ACB in terms of working with various groups that have similar likes.
Well, this is Pam Drake in Visalia, California. Maybe you're already answering my question. I'm wondering what talking points did you use? We're in a situation now where in our area they are currently tearing up the sidewalks. They're widening the roadway, one particular significant thoroughfare. And again, we're talking about cars, and we seem to also here be living in the land of it's not my problem. Get your helper to do it. Get your somebody to do it, is what we get. It's not my, I shouldn't have to spend the money. Why should my taxes go for your problems? What talking points did you use? What are you doing to, as you had said earlier, persuade others that this is be it transportation or traffic signals, and we're working on both. By the way, part of our bus area system is basically nearly unusable to us now because the streets are torn up, and they're just saying, well, take Dial-A-Ride, which is already overtaxed. What formula, if any, have you come up with that makes people listen to you and not just say, oh, get somebody else to help you, it's not my problem?
Good question. In one word, involvement. I have found myself over the years that when people are involved in a decision-making role, on the base decision-making role, people on the upper level are more likely to listen. I've been involved, for instance, took me 9 years, but I got Daytona Beach 2 years ago to establish a Mayor's Alliance for Persons with Disabilities, and just, 2 weeks ago, they called me, and the city called me and said, we'd like your committee to do an accessibility survey of the new police station. I called Public Works, and I've had them speak to my group. I called the Director of Public Works, and I said, you know, Main Street here in town has a signpost in the middle of the sidewalk. It's inaccessible, and somebody's got to run into it. I didn't say it, but I more or less quietly said that, you know, it's a good way to get sued. The next day, that signpost was removed. Part of it is that the idea of that they don't want to get sued, but I think the other part is that I try to be, rather than fighting, I try to work within the system and suggest, hopefully, reasonable ways to make changes. And a lot of the officials now are taking me seriously and taking other people on our alliance seriously, because we want to work within the system. The same thing, and Paul's aware of this, in our transportation system here in Volusia County. When we first started working with them in the late 70s, rather than going in and saying, you have to do this, and fighting with them, a group of us went in and said, we would like to help you to improve your system. And we actually, we developed a working relationship where we work together to get things done. And it's taken years, and it takes longer, but we've been fairly successful.
I think the other answer, Pam, is building coalitions. One of the things that we've found in Daytona when Doug and I worked together and subsequently as well is there are an awful lot of people who benefit in addition to folks who are blind. Dave's point about putting accessible pedestrian signals at school crossings is an absolutely perfect example of that. If you sit down with the school system and encourage them to write a curriculum that gets used at those crossings to teach kids how stoplights work, but also to teach them how they work, including the speech and including the other sounds that accessible pedestrian signals made, you've done two things at the same time. You've not only created a situation where you've found a good location for an accessible pedestrian signal, but you've also created another whole community of people who've learned about accessible pedestrian signals not as something for those people, but as something that's there and where we use all of the components of it to help us make decisions about crossing a street.
Hello, this is Danny. I want to know, the accessible crossing idea is a good one, but how do we educate other drivers? How do we educate drivers that just, I've talked to a lot of people, they don't know anything about the white cane law. They don't know to stop. Theoretically, I'm supposed to have the right of way, but I don't trust that at all. And I want somebody to talk about that. And also, how can I make sure that money machines are in my state? Thank you.
Well, that's two really good questions. Let me answer your second one first. One of the ways you can do, well, first of all, the banks that have decided that they are going to do talking ATMs are Bank of America, what used to be Washington Mutual, now it's Wells Fargo, and Wachovia. And other banks are doing it. What I would do is call the customer services number of your local, it's usually the big banks that do it, but call your bank's customer service and ask them. I think we need to pressure the banks to do that. It's a good idea, and the banks here are discovering it is a good idea, because putting in talking ATMs is a way for them to get more customers, and they're looking for making money. In terms of your first thing, in terms of the how to get accessible signals and dealing with drivers, that's a problem that I'm still looking for. Daytona Beach is like the mecca of blindness services in the state of Florida. Last year we had 4 people who were blind hit by cars. So it is continues to be a problem. I think the key is whether the law is enforced. I've said this to our police chief here, that as long as the police don't enforce the law, drivers are not going to pay attention. A good example of that kind of a thing is some areas are putting in red light cameras that would take a picture of people who go through a red light. Well, a lot of people didn't pay attention to red lights. A lot of people don't stop. But when there's a threat of a camera to take a picture of their plate when they go through a red light, the number of people that go through a red light drops dramatically. I think if the police would enforce the white cane law and pedestrian safety laws, you'd find drivers starting to pay attention.
I think there are 2 other things that I would suggest, Danny. One of them is we in Florida have tried to be sure that the white cane law is not only a part of the booklet that people have to study in order to get their license, but that it's also a part of the examinations. And for the most part now, almost all the versions now have white cane questions. And that helps to kind of get the word out so drivers have a better understanding.
Also, if you're in an area that hasn't done it before, TV stations and newspapers love stories that they can, you know, they can sell. One of the things we're doing all over Florida is to have, first of all, October 15th is National White Cane Safety Day. Every year, all across Florida, organizations, used to be organizations of blind people, now we're spreading out to other people, on the 15th or around that, have a White Cane Awareness Day, and to actually educate officials and educate drivers about the White Cane Law and pedestrian safety. And I think if you can get TV stations and newspapers to give you coverage, that'll go a long way to educating the public, drivers, and also blind people themselves.
One of the other things that Doug and I did very early on in Daytona was to be sure that copies of the White Cane Law ended up getting handed out to patrol people. One of the things that we're also doing now is being sure that the White Cane Law is a part of the curricula in most of the law enforcement training programs that operate throughout the state. So again, you have to find as many ways as you can to sell the idea of the rights of blind people as pedestrians. And I guess the other thing that I would say that you need to do is something that we're still not doing a good enough job at in Florida, and I'm not sure that we are throughout the country. I think we really need to be going back to states now and saying we really appreciate the fact that the laws were passed by this coalition of blind organizations and Lions clubs in the 1930s. But it's time that those laws got rewritten, and it's time that the penalties for breaking the White Cane Law are made much more significant, so people will think 5 or 10 times before they break those laws. The other thing that I think we really need to do is we really need to insist that local law enforcement people, when they see the law being violated by people, whether there's an accident or not, if there's a blind person involved in crossing a street at a time
when a vehicle runs a red light, even if that individual doesn't hit the blind person and there's no accident. In my view, we ought to be putting pressure on our police authorities to use those guys as an example and charge those folks at the very least with those misdemeanors and fines for running the light, so that what we eventually begin to have is a culture where it's no longer okay to mistreat blind people as pedestrians.
Yeah, that's a good thing. And I knew somebody once that got hit, a blind guy that got hit. And unfortunately, though, he was not able to identify who it was or what kind of car or anything. It's only because of a person who was nearby that could identify. And I don't know what was done. I don't know whether anybody compensate him or not, but he's in a wheelchair today because of all that.
The problem, Paul, and I don't know what the solution is, the problem is we don't have the support of the police. When I was hit, and it was a minor accident to be sure, but I was hit, and you know, the police officer basically gave me nothing, didn't give me the time of day. I mean, it was just like I didn't have a right to be on the street, and I was on the sidewalk. We were walking across the exit, you know, the parking lot exit when I was hit. I don't know what the answer is. I'm afraid that you guys are being too nice. I think we're going to have to start suing, and suing hugely. There's a lady up in Fresno who is now, you know, has permanent injuries. She was on the sidewalk. The car that hit her or jumped the sidewalk, ran, I guess it hit the bus bench, dislodged the bus bench. That hit her, knocked out some teeth, and did some other damage to her. I mean, she's walking around with permanent damage. And, you know, the driver, what's changed in his life? Nothing. You know, if I seem angry, I am. I am very, very angry at this and in despair because I don't see anything, I don't see any solution on the offing. Unless people start getting big damage claims won in lawsuits, I don't see any other way this is going to resolve.
I can think of two things from your comment. First of all, one of the things that we do in Daytona, and it was slow to start, but it's picking up, and that is when we have our White Cane Awareness Day, and we're starting to do it with, at other times during the year, we get public officials to come out and actually participate. A couple of years ago, I had our police chief and our mayor put on a blindfold, use a cane, and cross the street, and they were scared to death. The comments they made, you know, because of hearing the trucks and the cars and whatever, they understood why we were talking about the problem of crossing, because they experienced it. That's one thought. Second one, a little story. Here near where I live several years ago, a sighted lady wearing high heels caught her heel in the crack of a sidewalk. She sued the city of Daytona Beach, received $1.5 million for that. Plus, the city replaced all the sidewalks in a 2-mile stretch on both sides of the road so that wouldn't happen again. It ended up costing them several $1 million for that crack in the sidewalk. And I think that suit was what did it. Maybe, you know, Paul mentioned structured negotiation. I think the strength and the stick, I guess you could say, for that whole thing is that people have a choice. They can either voluntarily make the necessary changes, or they can get sued and would cost them a lot more money. That threat is always there. I prefer not to use it, but you're right. Sometimes you have to.
Doug, what do you think that the impact of tough economic times is going to be? Does that make our job easier or harder, or does it not matter?
Good question. I think it's going to give us a challenge. People who are fearful because of economic problems are going to not want to spend money. If we can figure out ways that they can spend their money and receive something good out of it, I think that's going to help. I think some people are going to use the economic thing as an excuse not to do things, but those same people would probably figure out a reason not to do things regardless. I think with the economic problems we're having, I think it's going to behoove all of us to get involved and get out there and do things. There really is plenty of money to do what needs to be done. It's a question of what we want to spend the money on doing. For instance, a library may think it's more important to spend $50,000 on painting and making it look nice, whereas I might think it's something else. I think, though, if some of us get involved in the decision-making roles, I think, regardless of the economic time, I think we can have some success.
Doug, is there a coalition that we can build with the green folks, i.e. with the folks who are interested in trying to preserve our environment? Do we have some things in common with those groups where we can build some coalitions?
We can. For instance, transportation. You realize that a train is going to use up a whole lot less of fuel and less air pollution and whatever than thousands of cars out there. So I think we could do that. I think you bring up a good point. What is going to lead to success is that we need to build coalitions with a lot of different groups that have power. We need to be creative and think of ways that there are things that they can support. I want to mention quickly, several years ago, Paul, you might remember, the bus system here used to run from 6 in the morning till 6 at night, and then it stopped. Well, the two blindness organizations here tried for years and couldn't get any place. Finally, we sat down and we worked with the Interfaith Council, and we also talked to the Chamber of Commerce and the hotel people, and got them to agree to nighttime bus service because it was an economic situation. We went from having 40 people saying they want a night service to having 5,000 people saying they want a night service, and it got passed.
Hey, Doug, one final thought from me. What about the, do you have a problem down there with the quiet cars that they've been talking about lately?
Oh, yes. As a matter of fact, you'll like this. One of our staff members I work at the Orientation Adjustment Center of Florida. One of our staff members happens to be blind, just bought a quiet car. And boy, we've given her a rough time over it. And ACB and other organizations are working on modifying that. I think it's going to change. I think we just need to work on it. It is a problem, but I expect that there will be some changes.
Hey, have you ever thought about this idea, getting cities to build over bridges, walk bridges over the busiest roads at the most critical intersections so that people could just go up a spiral staircase, go across the pathway and back down, or however they want to do it, and not have to even worry about how busy the intersection even is?
Okay, I think part of the problem we have, and maybe this is unique to us out west, I mean, I'm hard put to find pedestrians. We have a very small blind population, and Dave and I are probably the most active people in it. Most of the people are receiving public assistance, and their families take care of them. I am hard put to find a pedestrian to even start with. I sometimes jokingly, sometimes frustratingly call it place Carifornia. How do we, again, do we just get on the phone, start talking? I mean, we don't know who to talk to. Do we talk to the Chamber of Commerce? Do we try to find grants to work on script to help with transport? I mean, we're like two in a handful of. It's like we have two heads. And how do you deal with that situation? People, you guys get out, boy, you go places. Yeah. So how do we deal with that? Or is this just going to have to take a lot of creativity?
You've hit on a real problem that we have, and it's not just where you are, it's all over. The problem, the question is which came first. The problem is a lot of people don't go out because it's not safe, because they don't have the infrastructure they need, so they don't go out. Unfortunately, officials say, well, people aren't using it, so why should we spend the money to do that? We had the problem here in Daytona when we talked about putting wheelchair lifts on the buses, and they said, well, why should we spend the money to put wheelchair lifts on buses? People in wheelchairs don't use the bus. Well, you know, it sounds like a dumb thing, but people really believe that. It's going to be tough. I don't know how you're going to do that, but one of the things I think we need to do is get people out of their homes to do that. Perhaps you can do something like a white cane activity to start getting people out and involved.
The sad fact that it seems to me, Doug and anybody else, that I wonder which takes priority, states' rights or you know, the rights of the blind, the disabled, and anything.
I think it's a good question, Gary. I think there's a kind of a mix. I guess the one thing that I would say to Pam is one of the places where you might begin to try to build an alliance is, oddly enough, with hospitals and healthcare providers. There is this huge push right now post-heart attack to encourage people to get out and walk. And perhaps you can begin to build a coalition with groups who are a part of these heart healthy groups that are forming in lots of communities, even in California and Corrida or Corrida. We actually are beginning to have more pedestrians who are older and folks who are actually getting out who prefer to walk rather than to run for exercise for a variety of reasons. And those folks represent your natural allies in terms of beginning to make things happen. We are at the point where we need to wind things down. Let me give Doug a chance to perhaps make one final comment, and then we are going to close this evening's program. So, Doug, a final thought for folks?
Yeah, thank you, Paul. I appreciate you asking me to do this. I always look forward to encouraging people to get involved, to work on access issues. I think the key to making the world accessible is for those of us that are involved to get out there and actually work at doing things, get involved in our communities so that we're seen. It's amazing how many people call me to ask me a question just because they've seen my picture on the paper or in a newspaper or whatever it is. It's just that I'm out there in front of people. I encourage everyone else to do the same.
On behalf of Tuesday Topics, I'd like to thank Doug Hall for being our guest this evening. He really is an example of what you can accomplish by being a nice person who simply won't go away. And that's very much who Doug is. All of the folks in Daytona Beach know him as very persistent, but they also know him as too nice a guy to be insulted, so it's often simply easier to do what he wants. Doug, thank you so much for being a part of Tuesday Topics. If any of our listeners have questions, remember to send us email at TuesdayTopics@acbradio.org. And remember to tune in every week when we explore a topic as we did this evening. Remember, as Doug says, if we want things done, we have to do them ourselves. Good night.
To participate in the recording of Tuesday Topics, we invite you to join us on Tuesday evenings in the U.S. at 9 p.m. Eastern. That's Wednesday at 2 hours Universal. The program is recorded in the Our Place Politics chat room at ourplace.acbradio.org. That's ourplace.acbradio.org. All you need is a microphone that is plugged into your computer sound card. A few minutes before each program begins, those who are online will be happy to assist with audio checks and to answer questions about the chat room software. An announcement about the show, including information about the topic and the guest speaker, will be emailed to the ACB Radio Friends list. So we hope you will come and join us each week on Tuesday, when Tuesday Topics is being recorded. We'll look for you in the Our Place Politics chat room at ourplace.acbradio.org. Tuesday Topics is a production of ACB Radio Mainstream.